Friends, today's guest tells her story with head held high, nothing to hide. She will not be intimidated. Her truth won't be denied. And if Square Point Capital traces all our listeners to ask you what you heard, well, why don't you just tell them you heard it from a little bird? A bird. A bird. I said a bird, 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 bird is the word. I said a bird, 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 bird is the word. I said a ooh, mow, mow, papa, ooh, mow, mow.
Max.
Hear ye, hear ye, all ye who hear this here podcast, know this. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. Nothing discussed on this podcast should be considered investment advice. The hosts hold no licenses and are not financial advisors. Do your own research before making investment decisions, and we do hope you enjoy this podcast.
All right, and we're ready.
Michelle Leader, welcome to the Chartcast with TC and Georgia.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yes, it's been some time in the making, and we appreciate your flexibility. We were supposed to record last week, but we had a little teammate down, but we're back up and fully staffed and ready to go and thrilled to have you on the show. You have a fascinating story to tell. Why don't we begin as we always do? Who is Michelle Leader? Where were you born? Where were you raised? And sketch us sort of the arc of your career and get us to today.
So I am Brooklyn proud and grew up in an area of Brooklyn and called Sheepshead Bay. It's not one of the hipster areas that most people associate with Brooklyn, you know, Williamsburg or Bushwick now. It's kind of funny to me, like people talk about, oh, I live in Bushwick. And I'm thinking, wow, that was not an area that was trendy back when I was growing up. And Brooklyn was a very different place, quite frankly, back then. You know, it was not the hipster haven it is now. It was very much a different place. It's always amazing to me, you know, one of the beauties of it is that you can take a subway, you know, I mean, I was a subway ride away from Manhattan, which, you know, is a great city. Yet I knew a lot of neighbors who never even, you know, went into Manhattan. We used to call it the city. We were like, oh, we're taking the train into the city, even though technically Brooklyn is part of New York City. So it was kind of caught that at an early age that I was like, wait, we're in the city. Why are we taking the train to the city? You know, roots, strong roots in Brooklyn. I wear that proudly. Probably for the first 5 years of my kid's life, I would dress him in Brooklyn apparel, Brooklyn pride and all this stuff like that, which went over a little bit better on the West Coast because, you know, it was just like more unique then. I would probably have never done that if I was raising him in Brooklyn. You know, went to public schools in New York City. Big shout out to New York City public schools. I know they're going through some issues right now because of COVID, but I got a great education in New York City public schools. Went to little known fact in high school. I was a Westinghouse. It was called Westinghouse back then, a Westinghouse science finalist. Not the top 10. I was in the top 100. But it was called the Westinghouse Science Contest, and they looked at, you know, science projects from all over the country. And so back in those days, I was very much more interested in science than I was in business or finance, what I'm doing now. But when I got to where I went to college, to Brandeis University, which is in Waltham, Massachusetts, I decided that, I guess a lot of people, you know, it was hard. I was used to being the smart kid, even in high school. And all of a sudden you get to Brandeis and there's a lot of other really, really smart kids there. And I found that there were some people that were doing some pretty unethical things in the weed out classes in those early science labs, basically, where kids were switching. You know, you were one of the things you were supposed to start doing was you were early on. You had to assay a sample and figure out what the white powder was. And no, it wasn't cocaine. It was like salt or, you know, some innocuous thing, and you had to do tests on it. And somebody in my lab class had decided to switch the sample so that it was impossible to get the answers right? Because the teacher had the key. And so if you had sample three, you know, when they switched it, you would never get the right answer. And that really kind of pissed me off, so to speak. And I just felt like, you know, I have a very strong, I think, you know, maybe it is the Brooklyn roots. It's just sort of like strong right from wrong. That bothered me. And I wound up switching, you know, at that time I was taking an economics class, and I just really all of a sudden had a strong interest in economics and wound up pursuing that. And that's
Michelle. Were you a firstborn in your family?
I am an only child, which probably says a lot.
I was going to guess firstborn, but maybe only even fits the profile even more. I sense you really loved school.
I did. I did. I really liked school a lot. I had a good experience at my high school, you know, made some good friends who I'm still, you know, friends with, which, you know, was somewhat rare growing up in a big city, right? It wasn't a small town. Yeah, I think it was, and Brandeis was a great experience for me too. I really had a good experience there as well, and also made some very good friends there. And I think that the quality of the education was really, one of the things I loved about Brandeis was that you were able to take classes with, you know, professors, as opposed to at a bigger school, you know, usually the first 2 years, freshman and sophomore year, you're doing teaching assistants. From the very beginning, we had full professors who were teaching. One of my favorite Brandeis memories is in one of my economics classes, we had a midterm around, I think it was actually on Halloween. And the professor that we had at the time, and I wish I could still remember his name, but I remember what he did. He came into the auditorium, you know, where we were taking the midterm, and he was wearing like a tuxedo and a, you know, scary mask. And he said, here's the treat. And then handed out the test. He said, here's the treat. Now here's the treat. Now here's the trick. And that was probably one of the hardest tests I've ever taken ever.
He's the villain.
It was like brutal. Now the kicker to all of this was that he had just been denied tenure. And I think he was taking it out on us. The poor sophomore.
Someone
students.
Was going to feel the brunt of that.
Yeah, someone was going to pay for that. He had just been denied tenure, and that was his little twist of fate. And I think that was, I don't know, I want to say like I got like some kind of scary low score on it because I thought like, oh my God. But it was probably the hardest test I've ever taken, ever. So after Brandeis, you know, I was involved in the school paper, and I had been also, actually, I should say, I was also on my high school paper as well. So journalism was sort of a strong passion of mine. And so when I graduated from Brandeis, I started looking at papers, you know, newspapers, where I wanted to go. I knew that it was probably highly unlikely that the New York Times would hire a 22-year-old graduate. That was my hometown paper, was the New York Times. And I knew that that was highly unlikely they were going to hire me. So I decided to go down to Florida, where, you know, there were a lot of newspapers, because who reads newspapers, especially, you know, 25 years ago, older people read newspapers.
You were ahead of your time. About everyone is leaving New York to go to Florida these days.
Yeah, exactly. So I went down to Florida, and, you know, I wound up working for a paper that is now no longer in existence. My first paper that I worked for was called the Tampa Tribune. And there goes my dog.
You're the second guest to sit outside. This is great.
Okay.
We can hear the birds chirping. It's wonderful.
Okay. So if he gets too annoying, we can, you know, we can. I don't know what I'm going to do to silence him. he's a pretty chill dog. So I worked for the Tampa Tribune, and the Tampa Tribune went out of business, I think about 3, maybe 4 years ago. They were one of the, they had been acquired by the rival paper called the St. Petersburg Times. And then the St. Petersburg Times announced that they were buying them and shut them down. But one of the great things about working in Florida was that, again, was a very competitive market, and it taught me how to really break news and how to compete and break stories. And that was an important early lesson. So I'm really glad that I went down there. And as it turns out, I met my husband down there. So it was a double bonus. There you go.
So Michelle, you spent quite a bit of time as a blogger, which was a real up-and-coming form of communication and journalism. You've mentioned, you know, you went into journalism as you moved down to Florida. What really spurred your interest in becoming a financial reporter, and how did you find the experience of blogging?
Well, I think, you know, early on, I realized that, you know, it was competitive. I can go back to my college days, I guess. You know, my senior year of college, I worked on the local newspaper, like the actual, I had graduated from the college newspaper to the local newspaper, which was called the Middlesex News. It was in Massachusetts in the Framingham area. And they had sent me to cover in Massachusetts, they have governments called selectmen. And so they had sent me to cover a selectmen meeting for the town of Wellesley, which is a very affluent town. It's where Wellesley College is located, affluent town in Massachusetts, just outside of Boston. I think I was getting paid $25 or $30 for the story. Maybe I was getting paid $50. I can't remember. I doubt it was $50. I remember them arguing for like hours about like being $20 over budget. And I just remember watching the hours. Of course this was before cell phones, right? So I remember calling my editor, you know, saying like, do I need to wait until the end of the meeting? It's like, you know, this is dragging on. And my editor said, yeah, you got to wait there. And I started thinking like, if I'm going to like report on something, I want to report on something more significant than like a wealthy town being over $20 over budget. And that kind of really sealed my interest in business journalism. And I started really pursuing more business stories while I was still my senior year in college. And then I got a job as a business journalist at the Tampa Tribune, covering economics, really, like economic indicators and statistics and that kind of thing, and some small business stuff. But yeah, so that's what started, you know, the business passion, I guess, you know, the economics degree, plus, you know, moving into, you know, more real life stories and that kind of thing was particularly interesting to me. And blogging, you know, I started blogging in 2003, because that's when I wrote the book Financial Fine Print. And the book really, you know, if you've ever written a book or know somebody who's written a book, one of the challenges is you have to get it to the publisher by a certain date. And maybe it's improved now because, you know, it's been 17 years since I've written that book. But you have to get the book, your manuscript in, and then it takes 6, 9, 12 months before it sees the light of day. You know, there were a lot of things happening when I put out that book in the beginning of 2003, when I actually sent it to the publisher. You know, I just decided, one of my friends who I had met in Florida had connected me with someone who, one of his students, he was teaching a class at SVA, the School of Visual Arts, and he connected me with one of his students because I wanted to put up a basic website, really, for the book. The student had said to me like, oh, there's this new thing called Blogger and it's so easy and you can just do content and you don't have to have coding experience and everything. And so that's how basically Footnoted had started. And I decided that I was going to, this was, you know, there wasn't a master plan. This was 2003. So it was very early days for financial blogging. I like to say that I'm the grandmother of financial bloggers here because I've been doing it, you know, for so long. And
the early explorer.
Yes, the early explorer. Me and Barry Ritholtz, I think, started around the same time. I don't know. Barry, I can't remember if Barry was before me or right after me, but around the same time because we you know, got to know each other that way as early bloggers. You know, I think it was just a great opportunity to sort of, the way I consider it is, as a daily, you know, journalist, you're used to breaking news every day. This was a way to continue the conversation about my book on a daily basis. You know, what's interesting is if you go back to sort of like the Internet Archive, what you'd see is the first 2 years of the site, the blog, the you know, it was really like an author's page. Footnoted was an author's page where I basically did, talked about the book, and then the blog was sort of an offshoot of that. So you had to like click on a tab really to like find the blog part. Whereas now, of course, I mean, I changed that, you know, quite a few years ago, probably in 2005 or 2006, where I made the new content come up on a regular basis.
So Michelle, the book, Financial Fine Print, why don't you summarize the essence of that book for our audience and then how that led you to start Footnoted as a business, as sort of a proper consulting business, which is itself a very interesting story.
financial, you know, so the book basically, Financial Fine Print, was about my own personal experience as an investor. And what I found was that, you know, there were a lot of, you know, I had gotten interested in reading documents fairly early on. I remember going to a seminar, you know, pretty early on where Diana Enriquez, who is an amazing investigative reporter, you know, formerly of the New York Times, she's written a lot about Bernie Madoff, and, you know, she has quite a few scams under her belt. You know, I think she's semi-retired right now, but, you know, she had done a seminar that I had gone to where she just was like, you know, let the documents be your friend. That was one of the things that, you know, I went back and I thought, like, you know, what did these actual documents say, you know, during the WorldCom? This is going back to, like, sort of the, you know, the crises with WorldCom and with Enron, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s. And I remember looking through, you know, the SEC filings, and I had always, let me go back a minute, like, you know, back in Florida, my days as a journalist in Florida, I used to like to look at SEC filings from time to time, but this was very early days, and it was very difficult to actually look at SEC filings, you know, in anything close to real time. If I wanted, you know, there was a bank that I had covered during my time in Florida called KeyBank, and they were up to a lot of, you know, stuff, let's say. And it's not the KeyBank that now exists in New York and parts of the Midwest. I just want to, this was KeyBank of Florida. It was a totally separate bank, just not to get the KeyBank attorneys on top of me, because Lord sure. knows I don't need that.
You could wait in line.
Seriously. But I was able to get their, you know, they were a publicly traded bank, a small Florida bank, and they were, I was able to get their SEC filings. But because this was pre-internet days, this would have been around like 1990, maybe 1991. I had to actually order the document from a service called Disclosure, which would have someone stationed, you know, they would basically send someone to the SEC file, like, reading room, and that person would have to photocopy the document and then send it to me down in Florida. And what I found was, it was a really fascinating footnote. There was a footnote there, you know, the bank was saying, we're doing great. It was like the usual BS that you hear with any scam that you come across, right? The company was like, doing great, everything's growing, blah, blah, blah. And then there was a footnote in there, in the what I found in the SEC filing. It's like, the footnote basically said, we're being investigated by, like, the OTC, the RTC, like, it was like an alphabet soup of financial regulators, the SEC, I don't even remember some of these organizations, the Office of Thrift Supervision, I can't remember all of the different banking regulators, the state of Florida banking department. And I just thought, like, that's kind of an interesting thing to put in a footnote. And that's sort of where the real genesis of the footnote thing started, I guess, if you will. You know, if you think back to those early days, I mean, now, of course, it's so much easier. You just call up a document on your screen. You can do all sorts of, you know, advanced searching. It's really, you know, come quite a long way since I first, you know, began doing this.
It is really amazing. I find myself getting frustrated that I have to pause to log in to the SEC filing site and then laugh that think, my God, this is the only impediment I have from getting my hands on anything.
From anywhere, so, anywhere in the right. world. I mean, think about it. I've done this, like, you know, we drove an RV cross country earlier this year, and I was able to, you know, look at SEC filings, you know, in the middle of, you know, nowhere.
Yeah, no rest for the weary.
Yeah.
So, Michelle, was the book a success for you?
You know, I think it was a success in one sense. I mean, it certainly wasn't like Susie Orman's book. You know, I think it's very hard to be, you know, it was a success in the sense that it helped launch my career and launch the site, but it wasn't like a financial success in that sense. You know, I often joke around, and maybe one of the reasons I haven't written a second book is, you know, it's the amount of money I got in advance and the amount of time that I spent on it, you know, probably working at, you know, my local Starbucks or the Walmart or whatever, you know, pick a job, minimum wage job would have, you know, been more lucrative at the time. It takes a lot of effort to write a book, to do the research for a book and then, you know, actually write it and, you know, get it to the light of day. And, you know, advances have, you know, been falling pretty sharply even since then. I guess the answer to that question is yes and no. It was a success in one sense, in that it, you know, cemented sort of, you know, it created, it helped me launch the Footnoted website, or was this, you know, the spur for launching Footnoted, the website, which then, you know, helped me go on to other things.
Sounds like doing a podcast.
Yes, indeed. Now, you know, it might be worthwhile to share some of the success that did come from it, as you said, in the other sense. Maybe not financial success from the book specifically, but you have really received a lot of very positive attention and accolades through Footnoted. You did develop Footnoted beyond being this blog to promote the book and created a service that you then sold to the financial industry when it was a blog or in that phase, perhaps they overlapped. I believe at one point you were named one of the top 10 business blogs. You were interviewed a number of times. What was that like to suddenly find yourself growing a financial information business in a very new way, you know, online media, and starting to interact with the financial media as they were interested in the product you were providing?
Yeah, I think it was a great experience. I mean, sort of those early days of blogging, you think back on it and you just think, you know, maybe it is similar to podcasting now, like the early days of podcasting. Although I guess we're not really in early days of podcasting. We're sort of in, you know, mid, I guess. I'm not sure. Although I have seen articles that talk about peak podcasting, right? But anyway.
Yeah, we won't know till it's, what do you call it,
over.
End of podcasting.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
The look back.
So, you know, I think it was just an interesting, to me, you know, early on, you know, I think it was around, in the beginning when I first started the site, it was really to get the word out about the book, right? So that was, you know, like any author, you're trying to promote your book, you're trying to get out there. But, you know, the reality is that there's just not going to be, you know, a wide audience of millions of people for a book about SEC filings, right? I mean, you know, it's a mid-list, what's called a mid-list book, you know, so it's something that, you know, widely published, but I don't think they had expectations that it was going to be, you know, a multi-million dollar seller. You know, it wasn't like the Da Vinci Code or something like that, or even like a Susie Orman book or, you know, something by, you know, more basic personal finance advice, I guess, like Gene Chatsky from the Today Show or, you know, folks like that. So I think, you know, one of the things that was really, you know, helpful to me is it did, you know, I did a fair amount of speaking and traveling all over the country, mostly training other business journalists. I did that early on through, there was an organization that still exists called the Reynolds Foundation. They're now out of University of Arizona and in Tempe. And they had, you know, basically were paying me to fly around the country and teach journalists how to read SEC filings, which was a really interesting experience in the sense that, you know, just kind of trying to share some of my knowledge with these other journalists at a time when journalism was starting to change pretty rapidly, you know, and I think, you know, unfortunately, a lot of journalists just didn't, it wasn't so much the journalists themselves, it was the people in charge, you know, the people running the show. I mean, I remember one time I was, you know, the last daily newspaper that I worked at, you know, a few years before I wrote the book and before I launched Footnoted was a paper called the Poughkeepsie Journal in, you know, it's not quite upstate New York to upstaters, but it's not, you know, it's about an hour and a half outside of New York City, which is upstate to anyone who's from New York City. I remember talking to them about, you know, my editor, I said, like, you know, why don't we get rid of the daily stock listings in the newspaper? Because it was taking up four or five pages where they would actually run the tickers, you know, the daily close and the high, the low, the close. And I'm thinking, like, this is 1998, you know, maybe people who are really interested in stocks, they can get that on the internet. I'm like, and you can save those four pages. And they just looked at me like I was talking out of my, like, my butt. I mean, I might as well have just suggested, like, why don't I borrow your kidney for the weekend? You know, I mean, it was just, like, met with such, like, surprise, like, but this is the way we've always done it. And we've always run stock prices and people, we have to run it this way. And I was just thinking, like, okay, guys, you don't see the train coming down the tracks. And I think, you know, that was part of the problem of, you know, this was a Gannett newspaper. And, you know, but it wasn't just a problem with Gannett. It was a problem with other places as well, where they just didn't see the internet coming down the tracks and how that was going to impact everything. I mean, I remember, you know, from doing these Reynolds seminars, I had done a seminar. This is skipping forward a couple of years. Maybe it was 2005, 2006. I can't exactly remember, but they had flown me to Oklahoma City to do a seminar, you know, for the people. I was doing it at the Oklahoma City newspaper. And I remember talking to the publisher and I had made some kind of offhand comment about Craigslist. And the guy said to me, "What's Craigslist?" And I said, like, "If you don't know now, you're going to find out soon." And I just thought, like, how does a publisher at like, a, you know, I mean, newspapers were already starting to like lose, you know, buckets of money from Craigslist. And, you know, because of the classified ads. I mean, I remember when I came out of college, the New York Times classified ads used to be an entire section of the newspaper. And, you know, all of those ads that were, you know, the paper was just printing money from that. So it just was amazing to me, all of these changes and seeing some of them, you know, sort of up close and personal, and how people just didn't really get sort of those early days of the internet and how, you know, everything was going to change so dramatically.
So Michelle, you certainly got it, and you started Footnoted, which is a financial services company that basically sells unique information morsels that you could glean from SEC filings to people that would have a financial interest in knowing those things before the market. Talk to us a little bit about how Footnoted sort of evolved, who your clients were, how much fun it was, how successful it was, and then we'll sort of get into the latest and greatest here on the back end.
Yeah. So, you know, in the early days, I basically made a promise to myself that I was going to post something every single day by 11 a.m. I was living in Westchester in New York at that time. And, you know, I didn't really have a financial plan behind that. I was just going to like get the word out and do something based. It was sort of like a homework assignment to me. And I posted, you know, this is going back to the early days, like 2003, 2004, you know, as the site became, you know, more popular, you know, I would get advice from people like, "Oh, you only ought to talk about Apple." And, you know, they said, I don't even think Facebook was public back then. I'm trying to remember. "You all are only talk about like, you know, three or four companies. No one cares about all these other companies that you're talking about." I wanted to do something that was different. And to me, doing something that was different was looking for these nuggets in SEC filings and writing about them. But it also meant that, you know, if you think back to those like, you know, early, you know, mid to late 2000s, where everyone was chasing like SEO and everyone was tracing traffic, people were saying like, "Well, if you don't have at least 1 million visitors to your site, you're never going to make any money." There was no way in hell there were going to be 1 million visitors to a site about SEC filings. There's just not that many geeky people in the world. I think that people should spend, now I would argue that people should spend more time with SEC filings if you are invested in the market. If you own individual stocks, you ought to be reading them. But, you know, the reality is, you know, we also ought to, I don't know, you know, eat kale for breakfast every day. And that's not happening either. I think, you know, it became clear to me that an advertising model wasn't going to work for the site. And so I started to think about a subscription-based model. And again, this was very early. It was in 2008. And I launched a subscription-based product. And it was actually not a great time to launch a subscription-based product because in the fall of 2008, you guys probably remember what was happening. The market was kind of falling apart. But, you know, the subscription, you know, was a way to sort of sustain the site and keep it going. And what I thought was, you know, now looking back, I think that I priced it at the absolute wrong price. I was pricing it at $1,000 a year, which was too expensive for individual investors and too cheap for institutions. Institutions would often say, "Well, what could I possibly get it worth for $1,000? But I continued on in that path. And then, you know, I was connected with someone at Morningstar, and I had sought Morningstar out as an investor in the site to help grow the site. And then they just made me an offer to buy the site. And so in February of 2010, I sold the site to Morningstar. And I worked for Morningstar for the next 2.5 years, building the site. They allowed me, you know, they were able to allow, you know, because of Morningstar, I was able to hire a staff of people, a small staff, but a staff of people who were able to help me with content. One of the folks is Teo Francis, who's now at the Wall Street Journal, a very talented reporter, helped me with the site, was working with me at Morningstar, a couple of other people as well. You know, we had a small team and things were going okay, but I think it was not a great, in hindsight, you know, it was not a great fit for Morningstar, in the sense that, you know, they had a very different audience base. I mean, I remember pitching, you know, while at Morningstar, we raised the price to about $10,000 a subscriber. We really focused on the institutional investor. I remember two data points. I remember speaking at a Morningstar investor conference, and, you know, I gave a presentation about SEC filings, and the investors, you know, the people there who tended to be, you know, older, they were just like, I don't really care about this SEC filing stuff. Just tell me what stock to buy and when to sell it.
And I was just sort of like, CNBC injection.
Yeah. And I was just sort of like, well, that's not what I do. I'm sorry. You know, there's plenty of other places you can get that. And I'm happy to talk to you about those other places, but that's not what I do. And another data point was I was sitting, you know, I was pitching to a large hedge fund. I don't even remember who it was right now. Maybe it was KKR. But I was over, you know, in this wonderful conference room overlooking Central Park. And it was just, you know, for a New Yorker, it was just like this place, you know, beautiful space, you know, that you used to, you know, hear about in the movies. And the guy said to me, you know, sitting across the table from me, he was like, Morningstar. He's like, isn't that what my grandma uses to like research her mutual funds? And I was like, it was like, woo. It was like, as my son would say, roasted, you know, it just felt like, I was just like, yeah, I didn't know how to. So, you know, I think that, you know, ultimately we decided, you know, to part ways, and I was able to, you know, buy the site back from Morningstar. And then I relaunched it in 2013 and became independent again. And, you know, to be honest, I'm happier working for myself. I'm happier being independent. I think it fits, you know, my style of work and who I am, as well. It's the Brooklyn in me. You know, I often used to joke around when I made my first, you know, billion, I would donate to Brandeis, and I would say we'd, you know, the leader school of diplomacy. If you don't like it, you know, this is a family program, so I won't say the next part of the sentence, but
that's right. We're with you.
Okay. So I used to joke around about starting the leader school of diplomacy, and, you know, that was, yeah.
Michelle, tell us about some of the more remarkable, or memorable, nuggets that you found with your SEC scraping, some things that really were jaw dropping along the way.
Yeah, well, you know, Chesapeake Energy is probably one of my favorite ones. There was a, you know, I was reading their proxy statement, you know, this is a few years ago, obviously, before, you know, Aubrey McClendon was still in control. He wasn't dead. You know, there was a disclosure in there. One of my favorite parts of proxy statements, one of my favorite parts of SEC filings to read is always the related party transactions. It's just so fun. I mean, proxy statements in general are a good place to start if you're new to SEC filings, because if for no other reason, you can look at the compensation information. And who doesn't want to know compensation information? I mean, it's one of the last taboos in our society, right? Like, you're not going to come out and ask me, how much do I make a year? I'm not going to ask you how much you make a year. It's a taboo, right? You don't talk about that kind of thing. Maybe you talk about it with your spouse and perhaps a very close friend. But in general, we don't talk about how much we make. And yet here for the taking in SEC filings is all of this information about how much these people make. And it's fascinating. How could you not love that? And the footnotes to the, you know, to the summary compensation chart are equally fascinating. You know, I remember, you know, one company, which I think they had so many footnotes, they ran out of alphabet letters. Like, I mean, you know, it was like A through Z, and then they went to like AA, BB, CC. And I'm thinking, like, that's an awful lot of footnotes for a summary compensation chart. But anyway, back to Chesapeake Energy, one of the things that they had, the related party transactions, they disclosed, you know, about a map collection that they had purchased for the CEO. And the way that it was worded was just so crazy. It was, it talked about like how they had bought a map collection, an antique map collection, and they had paid 13 point something million dollars. I want to say $13.1 million for this map collection. And they were displaying it at Chesapeake's headquarters. And they knew it was worth $13.1 million because the guy who had assembled the collection appraised it at $13.1 million. And it was just sort of like the craziest. I mean, it was like you couldn't make this up, like the map collection. And eventually, you know, it showed that, like, you know, this was a crony board that was basically approving. I mean, what kind of company, publicly traded company, approves buying a map collection to display, you know, in corporate headquarters and buys it from the CEO, you know? I mean,
yeah, they better be doing awfully well.
Yeah. I mean, it's like craziness. And so you see footnotes like that. I mean, I've seen, you know, if you look at, you know, you look at like, you know, the related party transactions and you look at like the other compensation, you get to see like, you know, how much people are spending on, you know, security or corporate jets or, you know, all sorts of crazy. I mean, there was another company called, I think AG Shulman. And, one of my favorite footnotes there was about they talked about a fish shack that they had purchased, for the CEO. It was some place in like Canada. And they had purchased this, you know, they called it a shack. And it turned out that it was like some kind of like 10,000 square foot, you know, it wasn't anyone's definition of a shack. Let's put it that way. You know,
like as Diane Keaton says in Father of the Bride, she goes, "Nice shack, babe."
Yeah,
they pull up exactly. That huge Bel Air mansion.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it wasn't anyone's definition of a shack. There was another company, I'm drawing a blank on the name, but they were a trucking company and they had a hunting lodge that was like stocked with like, and I know I'm going way outside my knowledge here, like pheasants and other things to hunt. Now my Brooklyn roots are showing because like we do a lot of hunting in Brooklyn. Yeah. You know, it was, they had like, you know, and this is the company was paying for this and they were disclosing it. And I'm just thinking, this is just lunacy. I mean, it's craziness here. So there's just all sorts of like weird things that you can find reading, you know, reading the footnotes in SEC filings. And, I think that if you're an investor in a particular company, you ought to at least be paying attention to this. Or maybe you shouldn't own individual stocks.
Yeah, you know, it's probably gauche for me to say, but George and I are killing it this year.
Okay, you don't even need to ask.
We're just rolling in the money.
Yeah, yeah.
So look, things are going great. You know, you're carving out a it's nice to hear somebody else who's also passionate about reading SEC filings. I'm sitting across from somebody who is a who likes to swim in the details. Things are going great, and then all of a sudden, Square Point Capital happens. I know that there's a lot of sort of legal back and forth, and there's only so much you can talk about it, but why don't you begin by describing for our audience who Square Point Capital is and how they came on your radar as a potential client for Footnoted, and then to the extent that you feel comfortable, sort of describe what happened thereafter and what's going on now.
Yeah, so a guy had approached me in the March of 2006, said that he worked for a company called Square Point. They were a brand new quant fund based out of Europe. He said he was based in Geneva, but the fund was based in the UK. And he asked me, he said, "We're doing a lot of interesting things with SEC filings. We'd like to, do something with you. We're a very entrepreneurial firm." I remember him saying that, "We're a very entrepreneurial firm." And I thought, you know, okay, you know, I listened to what he had to say. And I just said, you know, "We're not really in the business of selling to quant funds right now. You know, thanks, but, you know, no thanks. I wouldn't even let him have a subscription." But then a year later, he reached back out to me again.
You said 2006. Do you mean 2016?
I mean, I'm sorry, 2016. Yes, I'm sorry.
Okay, just for everybody's clarity. Yeah.
Yes, 2006. It was March of 2016. So a year later, in March of 2017, he reached out to me again. And he just, you know, I can kick myself over and over about this. He caught me at a particularly bad time for me personally, in the sense that, you know, my mom had, you know, was about to undergo chemotherapy. And I was living in California, and I was about to fly back to New York to be with her for her first treatment. And it was a very emotional time for me. My mom, you know, was a single mom, and I'm very close to her. And even now, I feel like I can still, you know, it just really hurts me to talk about this. It really hurt. You know, I was just not, you know, I don't know if you've had a family member go through this, but you're just not thinking clearly. You can't, you know, you just can't think clearly. And I was not thinking clearly. And so he said, like, oh, we're interested in trialing the service. And I was just sort of like, okay, I'll give you a trial. And I can kick myself for now until eternity on that, you know, but he seemed, you know, he was a reputable fund. And we had not, up until that point, we had given trials. You know, when you're selling a product for $10,000, you need to, you know, give a real trial and allow people to look at it. But, you know, we gave him a trial and we had limits on that trial. And then next thing I knew, I had gotten an email from, you know, basically the back end of my system saying that he had reached the limit. We had allowed people to look at 50 items. Before they hit a limit, and he reached that. And then I thought, like, okay, you know, I'll reach back out to him and see if he's interested in subscribing. And by the time I reached back out to him, he had looked at over 17,000 pages. He figured out, you know, keep in mind that these quant funds, you know, and, you know, some of them are very reputable. I've had a number of conversations with some of them, but you know, these quant funds, they're basically, you know, run by, you know, computer scientists, PhDs in computer science. Every website has a vulnerability. And he managed, you know, these guys managed to figure out a vulnerability in mine. So instead of getting a limit of 50, I still don't know exactly what they did or how they did it, but they were able, there's no other way to explain how they were able to view 17,000 items other than that they changed the code on the back end. That they basically hacked in and changed the code on the back end. You know, I wound up having to hire, you know, after I noticed this, I sent him, you know, he sent me a note saying, oh, we've decided not to take a subscription. And I was like, oh, thanks for letting me know after you've taken all my content.
Right.
You know,
what's left?
What's, you know, like, of course you're not going to subscribe, asshole. yeah, sorry. I know you.
That's right. We'll bleep you.
Okay. No, actually, that might be one that we'll leave in.
Okay.
It's well deserved.
And, you know, and then I said, I was really, you know, he didn't respond. And then I sent a note to the chief compliance officer in the UK. And he responded a few days later with some kind of BS response that, like, oh, we didn't do anything. We deleted everything, blah, 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 you know, no harm, no foul. And I was like, no, you don't get to steal 17,000. I mean, you know, it's like the same thing if, you know, he had walked into my front door of my house and taken, you know, not that I have them, but like, you know, my family jewels, and then walked out the door and said, like, oh, you know, no big deal, right? Well, it was no big deal to him, but this is something I had worked on this for over 10 years, you know, 10 years of my life, like, you know, working on the site and building it. And, you know, how do you say, like, you know, I mean, these people, like, how do you look at yourself in the morning doing this to another person? You know, first of all, you know, and he didn't know that my mom, it was a very difficult time for me. He didn't know that my mom was going through chemotherapy and that, you know, of course, and, you know.
You think he would have been less dastardly if he knew that?
No, I don't know. Honestly, no. I think some people are just pricks and you got to, like, you know, deal with that. You know, I'm still very frustrated. You know, what I wound up doing is I, you know, after I got no response from the compliance officer, I reached out to a friend of mine who knows intellectual property, and he connected me with a law firm in the UK, and I hired them, and they sent a note, you know, a letter, and, you know, and then SquarePoint's attorney sent a letter back, basically denying everything, but taking, you know, a lot of words to say it. And then, you know, I decided to hire a forensic investigator to look at what, you know, really happened. And then after that, we delivered data to them explaining exactly what they did and how they did it and what they took and blah, blah, blah. And they sent back a letter basically saying, we did nothing wrong. You know, what was really frustrating to me is that, you know, this, as, you know, as this fund, as this was happening, the fund kept getting bigger and bigger. You know, when they first reached out to me in March of 2016, I think they had about $1 billion in assets. If you look at their most recent, you know, 13F, which was filed on Monday, they're now, you know, around $8 billion in assets. They couldn't figure out a way to, like, you know, pay for the information they wanted. I mean, you know, it's just, you know, it's really goes back to, like, what do you teach your children, right? Like, if your child stole something and came to you and said, look, Mom, this is what I got, and I stole it, wouldn't you be embarrassed for your child? Wouldn't you feel like you failed as a parent? That, you know, it's just, it's that right from wrong thing. I think we, you know, I have a strong moral compass, and I just feel that, you know, what they did was just inherently, you know, wrong and quite possibly illegal. But, you know, the problem is that I spent about $40,000 between the attorneys and the forensics. And, you know, ultimately, I'm a small business. And, you know, the attorneys had said to me, we can continue to pursue this. But, you know, you're probably going to be having to spend upwards of $200,000 or $250,000 on it.
It really does seem like, and we have guests on the show all the time that have various perspectives on this from different parts of finance or business or Silicon Valley or what have you that they're involved in. But it certainly does seem like the day and age of having that internal moral compass of what is right and wrong has really gone the way of the dodo bird. And it is, in fact, now what is permitted, you know, meaning if it's not punished, it's okay to do. And in fact, for a lot of businesses, that is considered a value, that the CEO or that the founder is willing to lie, stretch the truth, break the law, and what have you, is actually rewarded because it's through the name of innovation. But one of the things that I don't fully get yet about this chapter is, what were they going to do with that historical data? I mean, SEC filings are, you know, they happen on a timely basis. They provide information on what's going on in the business, but in particular, help people navigate going forward. So taking insights from what you find from 8Ks as they're dropped or, you know, any number of filings can only help you going forward. So if they're going back through the historical archives, what were they thinking to do with that? And why not just pay the $10,000 to get everything you're going to publish going forward?
Mm-hmm. I think probably they were trying to build an algorithm either to replicate what I do, you know, because which would be, mm-hmm. you know, reading SEC filings, figuring out what I consider red flags, probably back testing it. Like, oh, if she finds a risk factor problem, what's the likelihood?
I see. They now had thousands of data points of the things that you were looking at.
Yeah, I mean,
could build an algorithm around it.
What would it take for them to replicate that, right? Like, they would have to, like, go through SEC filings. I mean, they could probably outsource it to India or the Philippines or, you know, some Eastern European country. But it would take, like, a lot of resources and a lot of effort to do that. And I think that, you know, so that would be my guess. I mean, obviously I can't speak for them and, you know, I think they're, you know, a bunch of dicks, but, sorry, that was the Brooklyn in me again, but, you know, it's, you know, I think that, I have no idea what they did with it. I know that their fund grew pretty sharply. Can I, you know, tie it directly? I wish I could. Then it would be a much stronger, you know, legal case. If I could say that based on my, you know, my know-how, they were able to grow from 1 billion to 8 billion, well, you know, any attorney would pick that up, right? But you can't make that direct connection.
So, Michelle, they've been pretty nasty with you. What's the latest? You know, they've been sending you letters threatening to sue you for, you know, or to sort of...
Yeah, when they
cease and desist, and you know, this is you know, as you said, $8 billion firm. You're a small, you know, entrepreneur running your own business. What's the latest? And tell our audience what's going on.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, I had reached out. It was actually not reached out. There was an editor who I used to work with a very long time ago when I used to freelance for the New York Times, and we were just catching up. You know, a couple of months ago. I would say like, you know, the beginning of the summer, like maybe like June or May, whatever, it was just sort of like, hey, we haven't talked in like 5 years, what's going on? As you tend to do, I don't know about you, but I've had a number of those calls now that everyone's in quarantine. You see a name and come up in your LinkedIn profile that you haven't talked to in a long time. You're like, hey, let me talk to, you know, this was Richard. Let me talk to, you know, Richard had reached out to me. It was just like, you know, how are you doing? What are you up to? Blah, blah, blah. And I mentioned this story and he said, I'm going to write a story about that for Institutional Investor. And he spent quite a long time. I mean, I was in Maine at the time before I drove the RV cross country, but we were in Maine and he came up to Maine and interviewed me up there. And SquarePoint was not happy about this story, was not happy about the story running. And had, you know, tried to threaten the reporter, tried to threaten the reporter's editor, then decided that they were going to come after me and sent me a very, you know, threatening letter, which I posted on my website for anyone who wants to read it, can read it. And, you know, what they were asking me for is they were asking me for the names and the phone numbers of anyone who I had ever told the story to. And I was thinking, like, I told everyone. I mean, I'm not like, you know, I'm not the shirk in the corner type of girl. you know, I mean, they're probably, you know, and it's funny, even after the story ran, I heard from people who I hadn't heard from a long time. They're like, oh, yeah, I remember you talking to me about this 2 years ago. And I'm thinking like, oh, I don't remember talking to them about it. And I was like, I must have just been telling everyone about this because I was like so pissed off. I mean,
sure.
You know, I mean, in a sense, it was like footnoted is my baby. And it was like someone came in and they like just took my child to a certain extent. And then they didn't even seem to feel bad about it or apologize or say like, how can we, you know, can we offer you X? And, you know, I mean, it still puzzles me why they didn't say like, oh, this was a rogue employee. Actually, I shouldn't say it still puzzles me because I'm going to give you a postscript on this. So, you know, but I for a long time, I just didn't know why they didn't just say, hey, this was a rogue employee, you know, blah, 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 you know, this shouldn't have happened, you know, sorry, you know, but instead, you know, what they said that I was like, I was trying to extort them. That's what they actually told, you know, Institutional Investor was that I was trying to extort them for money. And I'm just thinking like, you know, I'm sorry, guys, this is like, you can't like, it's like the bad guy calling like out somebody, yes, and saying, you know, oh no, it's not me, it's you, you know, I'm rubber, you're glue, what's, you know, sticks to me, whatever. I can't even remember that stupid rhyme.
The technical term is gaslighting.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But what's interesting is, you know, after that article ran, I heard from somebody who told me, are you familiar with this other case? In New York, which is basically a former employee of SquarePoint who then went on to work for Millennium Capital, which is an even larger hedge fund, is basically SquarePoint sued this former employee claiming that the former employee had stolen his intellectual capital, you know, basically stolen SquarePoint's intellectual capital and tried to bring it over to Millennium. And there's actually a hearing next week on this in New York, because what happened was, you know, the guy was an employee, so it was a private arbitration, as, you know, a lot of companies do. You become an employee and you agree to, arbitration, so it wasn't a public record. But then they awarded him, you know, SquarePoint got an award of, I want to say like around $2 million against this individual employee. And, you know, they took it to New York State Supreme Court to enforce the award because it was a private arbitration. The guy said, I'm not paying. And then they took it to bankruptcy court and the guy filed for bankruptcy. And what's interesting to me is that in his defense in the bankruptcy, he basically says, he uses a term called unclean hands. And he basically says that SquarePoint's whole business model was stealing intellectual property from other people. So how can they come after him for stealing their intellectual property? Which is a really interesting, you know, argument to make, right?
Yeah, you can't accuse me of stealing when you taught me how to steal.
Basically, yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, if I teach my son, you know, if I teach my son how to go to the, you know, the corner store and, you know, steal stuff, You know, it's just, so it's very interesting. I'm going to be listening in on that bankruptcy proceeding next week, and you know, very interested to hear what happens from that. And you know, so they have not reached out, you know, maybe I'm jinxing myself, but they have not reached out to me since that letter. You know, for all I know, they could come after me still. You know, truth, you know, one of the things I learned as a journalist early on is truth is the ultimate, is your ultimate defense, right? You know, absence of malice, you know, is what's going on here. And so, you know, the documents clearly say what they did. And, I'd love for a court to take this up and look at it, because, you know, I find it hard to believe that, you know, I would be the wrong, you know, I think most people would assume that I was the wronged party here.
Well, certainly very sorry that you were taken advantage of in that way, and hope it resolves itself sooner than later so you can put it in the rearview mirror.
Yeah.
One of the things that we do on our show is we solicit questions from a tier of our patrons. So we've recently started having a listener-supported model on this show to cover costs and so forth. And we have a tier of patrons who are really quite remarkable. There are 420 funding secured patrons, which is a little homage to the securities fraud committed by Elon Musk when he said that he was taking the company private at 420. In any event, patrons at that tier are able to submit questions in advance for our guests. And one of the questions that we have for you that comes from that group is really fascinating. It's you know, a little bit off of what we're talking about, but certainly very related, which is, what have been your impressions of the SEC under Jay Clayton? And have you been paying much attention to the news of his resignation from the SEC? I imagine this is very much on your radar. Where do you think he's going? What do you expect with the new commissioner?
I have been paying attention to it. You know, I think that, you know, he's done, you know, it's so funny because someone had reached out to me the other day and said, you know, what did I think about it? And we had like a direct message thread in Twitter, you know, about it. And I said, well, I don't think he was as bad as Chris Cox. You know, in general, commissioners, you know, the chairmen who were appointed by Republicans, and this is not necessarily partisan, but, you know, they tend to be more anti-regulation, right? Less regulation. And that was certainly Jay Clayton's role at, you know, the SEC. I think most people would agree with that. It fits the classic Republican mold of, you know, let's reduce regulation, make it less, you know, onerous for these publicly traded companies, you know, to have to file stuff. You know, I think that in general, you know, look, if you want to be a publicly traded company and, you know, if you want to be a publicly traded company, you've got to, you know, play by the publicly traded company rules and not try to, you know, get around these things. And if you don't want to be a publicly traded company, there's options for you doing that. But if you want, you know, my mom's retirement money, you ought to be able to, you know, provide some basic information, some basic disclosure and not hide stuff. And not play tricks like Tesla did relatively recently, as I noted in that post. You know, it's you know, anyway, so Jay Clayton, I think, has done a good caretaker job. I think he did a misstep when, you know, with that proposal of trying to change the 13F regulations. I think that 13Fs need to be changed. But I don't think that, you know, increasing the amount of money, assets under management, necessarily was a good step. And you could tell by the overwhelming response from comments. I mean, I think that was probably the most commented on SEC proposal ever. You know, that, you know, obviously, you know, that was a misstep on the SEC's part. Where is he going? I have no inside track on that. My guess would be, you know, he was probably, you know, a very well compensated attorney at a, you know, fancy law firm, and he'll probably, you know, I'm sure he would probably go back to that.
Yeah, nobody's crying for Jay Clayton.
No.
He'll be okay.
He'll be okay. He's going to have a soft landing.
Yeah, he'll be okay. The revolving door will continue to revolve.
Yes.
He'll be okay. So, Michelle, look, you're a barrel of fun. We could talk to you all day, but we're coming up on the allotted time, and we're very grateful for the time you spent with us. Talk to us. What's the current state of Footnoted? What's the future for Michelle? I know Footnoted is on a bit of a hiatus as you sort of work your way through all of this SquarePoint stuff. What's next for you? What's going on today? And where can our audience find more of your stuff?
Well, I'm still pretty active on Twitter. The site is on hiatus right now, although I did, you know, I do posts from very periodically. There's some exciting stuff coming up for Footnoted that I hope to be able to announce soon. Hopefully starting, you know, by the beginning of the year. So I'm really looking forward to that. You know, I love talking about SEC filings, and you can see that as a real passion of mine. And so feel free to hit me up on Twitter if you have a question and I can help you out. I'll try.
Well, that's terrific. And we'd love to have you back when you're ready to, you know, talk about your next chapter and some of the other things that you'll be bringing to market. I have a whole nother page of questions and notes of other things that I'd love to ask you about.
The book giveaway we have to talk about.
Yes, of course. So for those listening, and we'll promote this on Twitter as well, but Michelle has graciously offered 3 copies of her book to any of our listeners that become new patrons in the week following the publication of this episode.
New patrons of the Charcast.
Yes, thank you, yes. To be clear. So that is patreon.com/thechartcast. And so any new patrons for this week, we'll send a copy of Michelle's book, Financial Fine Print, out to you.
Wonderful. Thanks, Michelle. It's been really great. And we look forward to having you back when you're ready to tell us what's next.
Great. Thanks so much for having me, guys. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
I got the stock right here, and it is on a tear. I graphed the newspaper clips from the whole past year. Just tell me what to buy, and I'll be flying high. That footnote's wrong. He beat the rap. He's a real swell guy. I'll take a trial free, a little look and see. But if you value what you got, don't turn your back on me. Trial free. What to buy? On a tear. I got the stock right here.